From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! San Jose Mercury News reporter Gary Webb responds to his own editor's editorial apologizing for his series. Activists organized their own ceremony against last night's Clio Awards, the highest honor in advertising.
A growing number of marketers on the World Wide Web are aggressively targeting children, or as the industry sometimes likes to call them, digital kids, or cyber tots. In this new unregulated media marketplace, advertisers are pursuing a no-holds-barred approach to go after America's children.
Just like we have a Superfund to get rid of toxic waste dumps, what about the toxic waste that pollute our mind every day or the minds of our children? Why not think of setting up a special fund financed with a tax on advertising and using that to promote art and education, for example?
And refugees and famine in Haiti.
And it's striking because these are not people fleeing military repression anymore. They're fleeing failed economic policies.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Zairean rebel forces broke through the government's last major defensive position short of the capital and announced that they would arrive in the city within hours in their final push in a seven-month fight to topple Mobutu Sese Seko. President Clinton has signaled a willingness to compromise on certain late-term abortions. The White House says the president is looking very carefully at a bill proposed by the Senate Democratic leader that would impose a limited ban on all abortions after the point at which a fetus could survive outside the womb, but would provide exceptions when a mother's life or health is threatened. A GOP measure vetoed last year bans one type of late-term procedure, except when the mother's life is in danger. Such late-term abortion bills are being offered all over the country, and pro-choice advocates are afraid that they will be used as a wedge to overturn Roe v. Wade. Timothy McVeigh's attorneys have tried to discredit the prosecution's star witness. Under fierce cross-examination, Michael Fortier admitted changing his story since the Oklahoma City bombing, but denied tailoring his testimony to fit news reports or lying to escape drug charges. Prosecutors introduced the Ryder truck key, bolstering his testimony that McVeigh took him to see the federal building he intended to bomb. It was found in an alley where Fortier and McVeigh planned to park his getaway car. James Earl Ray's hunting rifle was flown to Rhode Island under police guard for tests aimed at determining once and for all if it's the gun that killed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The bullet from the slain civil rights leader also arrived yesterday at the state crime lab, where the gun will be fired and test bullets and the death slug will be compared over the next 3 days. The tests were to begin today. The nation's major airlines sued to block a city of San Francisco ordinance requiring them to offer health benefits to their employees' domestic partners. The lawsuit filed by the Air Transport Association says the city has no right to regulate air carriers. It seeks an injunction barring enforcement of the ordinance, which goes into effect June 1st. The law requires companies doing business with San Francisco to offer the same benefits to legally registered domestic partners as they do to spouses. And the Cuba Friendshipment Caravan, a group of activists challenging the U.S. embargo against Cuba, is on the Canadian border. Harriet Tansman, who works at Pacifica Station WBAN in New York, is there with them at Buffalo, where they're about to go over into Canada.
WBAI is at the Canadian border with 250 people. 150 of them are going on the Friendshipment Caravan to Cuba. The rest of us are going over the bridge with some goods that are not allowed by the U.S. government and some that are. We have tons of materials, from eyeglasses to medicines that the U.S. government doesn't allow, like medicines for people who've had chemotherapy. So instead, children are throwing up about 20 times a day because they can't get this medicine. A Braille computer, just books, all kinds of stuff. And we have people from about five countries and about 50 children, which is a new thing for us. We have 25 kids from the Bruderhof. We have college kids from a couple of states. And the one I'd really like you to talk to is a guy named Tony from England, who has brought his cab, which he has decked out, painted in the Cuban colors with a British flag on top, that he drives around London, talks to everybody about Cuba with, including the MPs in Parliament who he drives.
Tony Cacavoni, second-generation Italian. Very honored and proud to be leading the whole convoy of caravans with the London cab. And we're going to break this blockade. It'll be ordinary people that will break this blockade, ordinary Americans, British people, because the Americans I speak to in my cab back in London, they're absolutely appalled when they hear both sides of the story. I'm not saying I know both sides completely, but I think it's more balanced in Europe than what the Americans have been told by the American press. And it's an outrage. It's a shocking, shocking story that humanity should deprive a third world country of medicines. And can I just add this, that the country we're talking about here, Cuba, has got a free, universal, socialized health service, which is the envy of the Caribbean, if not Latin America. And its primary health care beats the United Kingdom. And it's an outrage that this Helms-Burton Act prevents food and medicine going into Cuba. They're threatening nobody, the Cubans. All they're asking for is normal trade and normal diplomatic relations with the West. And what I do in London as a cabbie, I lobby the MPs 6 days a week. As soon as I get any MP in the cab from the House of Commons, I've spoke with Tony Blair. I had an impromptu meeting with him outside a TV station. And I've been doing this for 3 years after an excellent holiday 3 years ago. And that was a recommendation from Canadian tourists in my cab in London just over 3 years ago. They recommended a trip to Cuba. That's what I did. It was safe, clean, unspoilt, civilized, no guns, no drugs. And I come back to London and I had to do something. And what I did it by putting a message out to everyone through my cab, because I decked the whole thing out with the Cuban colors, subject to permission by the Public Carriage Office, which is a section of Scotland Yard, of course. And that's what I've done, and that's what I'm going to continue to do until the blockade ends.
Members of the Cuba French shipment caravan again on the New York-Canadian border as they attempt to go into Canada. And you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm joined now by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez, a columnist with the New York Daily News. Nice to see you again, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and how are you?
Good. And we're going to start off with a piece we've both been following since last summer when the San Jose Mercury News series began, and we're going to talk about the latest development. The executive editor of the San Jose Mercury News has acknowledged that its controversial series suggesting a link between the CIA and cocaine trafficking was, quote, oversimplified, omitted important conflicting evidence, and, quote, fell short of my standards, he said. He is Jerry Seppos. He wrote in a column on Sunday that the Dark Alliance series strongly implied CIA knowledge that a drug ring linked to the Nicaraguan Contras was selling crack in Los Angeles in the 1980s. And he said, quote, I feel that we did not have proof that top CIA officials knew of the relationship. We also did not include CIA comment about our findings, and I think we should have. Well, when they were originally published last summer, the Dark Alliance series of articles by investigative reporter Gary Webb caused a sensation, prompting black congressional leaders headed by Congressmember Maxine Waters of Los Angeles to demand an independent investigation into the role of the CIA in illegal drug trafficking. Then CIA Director John Deutsch went so far as to hold a town meeting in Los Angeles where he said a full investigation into the allegations would be held. For its part, the media establishment, led by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, attacked the articles and claimed that radio shows and street corner gossip had distorted the facts of the CIA's role in drug trafficking. Joining us right now to talk about this extraordinary move of the editor of the executive editor of the San Jose Mercury News is Gary Webb, the reporter at the San Jose Mercury News, who broke the Dark Alliance series. I should say, by the way, that we did invite Mr. Seppos to join us, but he didn't and just said his words stand on their own. So we welcome you, Gary Webb, to Democracy Now!
Hi, it's good to be here.
Well, good to be with you. Why don't you start out by telling us your reaction to Jerry Seppos's basically allegations against you, saying that you just engaged in shoddy journalism?
Well, I don't think he said that. I mean, if you read the thing carefully, and believe me, you have to read it very carefully to get this out of it. He says that the story essentially is true, that the Contras were selling cocaine in South Central Los Angeles. They were selling large quantities of it, and the money from the sales of the drugs were going to the war effort. And, you know, as he noted, we have solid documentation for that. What he took issue with was a couple of things which I consider sort of trivial. And the other problem is that a lot of the criticisms he made in that column are moot, because we've been investigating this for 8 months since, and have come up with a lot of additional information that so far the Mercury's not printed. And it's specifically on point with a couple of the issues he raises. Primarily, you know, one of the issues he says is that, you know, the figure that we used, which was sort of a broad figure of millions of dollars going to the Contras, he said, was an estimate. I think it's obvious to a lot of people that when you don't put a number on something, when you just use a phrase like millions, it is an estimate. Subsequent to that, however, we've interviewed one of the couriers of this drug ring, who told us that he took $5 to $6 million down in 1 year alone in 1982. I tried to persuade Mr. Seppos that this is information that we ought to share with the public. And so far, we haven't done that. The other problem is that we have evidence now of direct CIA involvement with this drug operation. We also have evidence of very high-level CIA knowledge of at least portions of it. Again, this is information that was turned in several months ago and has not appeared in the paper. And I can't really get a straight answer as to why that information is just sitting there.
Well, Gary, what kind of a pressure came on the paper, as far as you can tell, in terms of the public outcry over the series from government institutions or the federal government itself?
I don't know about any. I mean, there was pressure on us initially not to print this information about Danilo Blandón, who was one of the drug traffickers that we wrote about, from the DEA. I mean, they were insistent that we not do this, and tried to set up various enticements for us to leave that bit out. After the series appeared, I mean, there was a huge controversy. And, you know, I think it was a situation where you had us against the world, essentially. You know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times were all saying that, this wasn't any big deal, that you know, there was only 5 tons of cocaine sold by these folks down in South Central. And I think, you know, journalists are like anybody. They succumb to peer pressure very, very easily, and which is why you don't see more stories like this. If you go back to the 80s and look at what happened to Brian Barger and Bob Perry when they did their Contra cocaine stories back in the 80s, the same thing. I mean, it was them against the entire rest of the press. And it's not a comfortable position to be in. I don't mind it, because I know the story's true, but I think other people get a little knock-kneed when that happens.
Well, one of the things that your editor said in his letter was that the series had oversimplified the spread of the crack epidemic and blaming it sort of on Ricky Ross and the its explosion eastward from Los Angeles. Yet I seem to recall that the L.A. Times itself had pinned a lot of the blame for the expanding crack epidemic on Ricky Ross years before. And what's your sense? Do you think that charge, that the oversimplifying the spread of crack was accurate? Or?
No, I don't think so at all. And I think it's very clear when you look at the historical record that it started in South Central Los Angeles. It spread primarily through the gangs. I mean, there are federal government reports that we have which said that, they found evidence of Crip crack dealing and blood crack dealing in 45 cities in 32 states. And this was a couple of years ago, and it's still spreading. I mean, part of the problem is that the media oftentimes believes its own propaganda. And one of the biggest propaganda efforts that I came across in this story was the idea that crack happened overnight, that in 1986, suddenly we woke up one morning and we were engulfed by this tidal wave of crack. And that's pretty much the prevailing media belief to this day, which, you know, it's nonsense. I mean, it started very slowly. It started in South Central, and it took years to spread to other cities. So I think Seppos and I just disagree on the whole epidemiology of crack. And unfortunately, he's the editor, and he gets to write a column, and I don't. I stand by the story.
You've said a few times now in this brief conversation that you have more evidence and that you've attempted to write more articles.
I have written more articles. They just haven't appeared in the paper.
So what's happening?
Nothing. They're just sitting there. I mean, George Hodel, who is my Nicaraguan colleague who's been working on this with me, we turned in four more parts of the series in February, and nobody's even lifted a finger to edit them. They're just sort of sitting there.
Didn't Jerry Seppos just call them notes?
He was quoted in the Times as calling them notes. I was frankly astonished to see that. I mean, unless his definition of notes is different than 99% of the American public, that's just not true. These were very long, very detailed stories.
Like the first series you did?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the second part of the series it's probably even more explosive than the first part. The second part deals with who in the government knew about this, which federal agents were either aware of this and did nothing, or in some cases were working with the members of the drug ring. We've got a paper trail now that goes all the way into the National Security Council. And, when we were sent out to do these additional stories back in October, the feeling at the newspaper was, let's go out there, let's get this stuff, let's put this stuff in the paper, and let's shut everybody up. And I said, that's a great idea. We went down to Central America two more times, came back with what I thought was just dynamite stuff, and it has just sat there. And instead, we have this column that ignores a lot of the stuff that we found then and pretends it doesn't exist and says, well, I guess we weren't as right as we thought we were. The truth is, we were more right than we knew.
Have you? I'm familiar with the whole process when you initially break a story that you inevitably get all kinds of people coming forward with even more tips, and I'm sure that must have happened. You must have been overwhelmed.
They were coming out of the woodwork. Yeah, they were coming out of the woodwork. I mean, and it people that I had been looking for a year suddenly surfaced after the story came out. And we went down and we interviewed them. We interviewed pilots that were flying this cocaine in and out of the country. We interviewed the man who was taking the money down there. It was really a mess. And, we got, like I said, we were more right than we knew. I was astonished how deep this thing went.
Gary Webb, if you can't publish this new series in the San Jose Mercury News, would you like to name the names here on Democracy Now?
I'm going to give the Mercury the opportunity to print this stuff first. If I can't reach some agreement with them, then I'll have to see what else we can do. But, I mean, it's sort of a hard position to be in, to have your paper sort of take a dive on a story that is true, a story that they know is true, and pretend that we don't have this other information.
Are you thinking about leaving?
No, I'm thinking about staying there and fighting to get these stories in the newspaper. I mean, whatever the situation is, I mean, I like the Mercury News. I've liked working for it. I like the people there, and I think it's a good, honest newspaper. I find these latest moves to be very bizarre, however.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I'm personally familiar with one of the executives there, Jay Harris, the publisher,
right,
who I used to work with him at the Philadelphia Daily News, and I generally considered him a more courageous news executive than most others, and certainly he's one of the few African-American publishers of, if not the only, of a major daily newspaper,
right,
in the country. What has been Harris's role? Has he met with you, or has all the word from management come down directly through the editor?
You're talking about a level now that is not visible to mere mortals like me. I'm sure Harris was involved in some of this. What the extent of his involvement was, I don't know. I mean, I did not talk to him about this.
And yet the paper has let you continue the investigation, presumably. You're there as a regular reporter, and you've done this four-part series.
Right, and that's all I've been working on since the series started. It seems to me, and it's certainly my immediate editor is intent on getting these other stories published. I got to tell you, I don't think the chances are all that great, given the fact that, the papers come out with this strange column, which says that we don't have information that we do have.
Is there any direct CIA intervention there? I mean, even in taking the CIA seal that you had originally on the Dark Alliance series with a person smoking crack in the middle of it, taking that off?
If there was, I don't know about it. You know, I've heard rumors that the CIA attorneys showed up at the paper. I never heard saw anything to substantiate that. Again, I mean, they don't contact me. If there's contact going on, it's above my level. They don't seem to like talking to me very much for some reason.
Well, Gary Webb, we thank you for talking to us. Gary Webb, a San Jose Mercury News reporter who broke the series The Dark Alliance last year, the story behind the crack explosion. And we do look forward to seeing these next series of articles published, hopefully in the San Jose Mercury News.
I hope so, too.
Thank you for being with us.
All right.
You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to the Counter Mm-mm Awards. We're not supposed to say Counter Cleo. You'll find out why. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Last night in New York City, the advertising industry held its version of the Oscars. They're called the Clio Awards. But for the first time, the public relations industry is being challenged by a group of media activists. Last night, they held the Counter Mm-mm Awards. They are not allowed to say Counter Clio Awards ceremony, where they handed out their own negative awards. And we're pleased to be joined this morning by some of the presenters at last night's counter ceremonies. But we're going to begin with Larry Adelman, co-director of California Newsreel, now in its 29th year, the country's oldest documentary film production and distribution group. And he was one of those who organized last night's event. He wasn't able to be with us this morning, but I asked him last night about what he thinks should be done about advertising.
I'm not sure what should be done about advertising. There are a lot of proposals out, such as limiting the tax deduction for advertising, or as Stuart Ewan has suggested, charging a rent for commercial use of public space, such as the airwaves. The airwaves, of course, is belongs to the public, but advertising gets a free ride on it. They don't pay any special fee for using public space, or look at the billboards that we have to look at. The real issue, however, I think, is not the merits of any particular proposal, but that we as a nation begin to have a national conversation as to whether or not we think that we should put some limits on advertising and how to do it, and we have not had that discussion as of yet.
But companies do pay the networks to have advertisements, for example, on television.
Sure, companies pay the networks to have advertising, but the networks, who are supported by advertising to the tune of billions of dollars a year, get that spectrum for free.
So who should be paying the tax?
Well, whether it's the networks paying an extra amount of money or whether you pay a fee for every dollar of advertising that's purchased is not really the issue at this point. The real question is that we as a nation have to decide that just as we don't want our food polluted with toxic waste, that why should we have our minds and the minds of our children polluted with toxic waste? Why not begin a discussion as to how much advertising is enough? We look at advertising as a given, as a natural force, as at most a necessary evil. We never question it. As Bernard McGrane said in The Ad and the Ego, and many other people have pointed out, it's like the fish in the sea. We live in that environment, and we don't question the environment of advertising. But it's not natural force. Some people might say it's a force greater than nature. But in fact, we have as a society made a choice that we are going to pursue the great god mammon of consumption at any cost. Advertising is this engine. But that is a choice that we have made, perhaps not consciously, but we as an affluent society don't necessarily have to follow in that, you know, down that path.
You mentioned that ads are written off as tax deductions.
Right. Every ad expense is a business expense. Just like manufacturing a car, the manufacturing part or the labor or the cap is in fact a business expense which is tax deductible. So all of ads, ad advertising, is tax deductible. So, but ought it to be tax deductible? Why not, for example, put a tax, like we have a special tax on cigarettes, why not a special tax on advertising? Or if not advertising as a whole, what about advertising aimed at children on all those Saturday morning television shows? Or why not a special tax on advertising tax on products that we think perhaps are not the healthiest, such as cigarettes or beer or alcohol?
In California, you've got the tobacco tax that was just voted in.
Right. In California is an interesting, is a very interesting case because we have passed a proposition which basically took revenues, and I'm not certain exactly what the fiscally exactly how it all works, but the fact is that the revenues that come from cigarettes, part of the state's, from the state cigarette tax, were passed in a public proposition and are used to finance anti-smoking ads. So why not, thinking about that, why not use that as an example as how we might take that a step further and start a special, if we want, a special anti-advertising or pro-consumer superfund, just like we have a superfund to get rid of toxic waste dumps. What about the toxic waste that pollute our mind every day or the minds of our children? Why not think of setting up a special fund financed with a tax on advertising and using that to promote art and education, for example? God knows the schools, at least in my city, San Francisco, are terribly underfunded and could use every penny they can get.
You were instrumental in the Counter Clio Award ceremony.
Well, it's not the Counter Clio Award ceremony. It had been formally called the Counter Clio Awards, but now now it's the advertising ceremony that dare not speak its name ever since the Clio people sent us a cease and desist letter. So we aren't allowed to say it's the Counter Clios.
Why?
Well, they felt it was a trademark violation. It was infringing upon their Clio trademark. Now, whereby our attorneys felt that we were in perfect First Amendment grounds in order to go ahead and use the term Counter Clio, we decided not to fight because the fight would have been a distraction from the real issue. A David and Goliath battle over trademark is not the point. The point is really the consequences of advertising, the consequences of advertising on lung cancer rates, on traffic and pollution, and the consequences of advertising on the minds of all of us. And that's the issue, and we didn't want to get involved in a battle over trademark infringement.
I mean, it's really unbelievable, though. It makes me think, for example, if you criticize McDonald's or a corporation, they can start to say, you can't use our name when you criticize us.
Well, you can use their name, and you can criticize them. We all know we can get a march in front of the Clios with signs saying, down with the Clios. However, they can go ahead and start legal action against you. The problem is it takes money and time and energy to fight such lawsuits. They're certainly a nuisance lawsuit, and I'm confident that that we would prevail in such a suit, but as I say, we felt it would be a distraction from the real issue. So we chose not to pursue it. And we are now as Neil Postman called us this tonight, the Schmios. But maybe we should have a contest for next year to see what it should be the best name for the Dubious Advertising Achievement Awards of 1998. And we can start right here on this show.
Larry Adelman, co-director of California Newsreel, who was one of the organizers of last night's Counter Clio ceremony. We think we can say it. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, who was also there last night at the event at New York University. And we've got two guests with us who were the presenters, Makani Temba, the co-director of the Praxis Project in Oakland, California, a media and policy center, and Shelley Pasnick, who is the director of children's policy at the Center for Media Education based in Washington, D.C.
Well, I'd like to start with Makani. You gave out the award, the Jimmy the Greek Big Black Buck Award, for the most demeaning targeted marketing campaign. Could you tell us a little bit about that award?
Well, essentially, the award was to really bring out and highlight the ways that the advertising industry demeans African Americans every day. People were outraged when Jimmy the Greek made his comments about, you know, the big black buck mixed with the wench and et cetera, and people wanted him fired. But the advertising industry does that to our communities every single day.
In what ways?
Well, you see a lot of stereotypical images, particularly for products that sell really health-undermining products like malt liquor, cigarettes. You see ads for malt liquor that say things like, get your girl in the mood quicker, get your Jimmy thicker, and with a certain brand of malt liquor. I mean, ads that are so demeaning, so stereotypical, that if you came from another planet, in fact, people who are on this planet assume that African-Americans have fairly limited dreams, are people who are essentially into some very base kinds of activities, because in some sense, in which advertisers have even said to me, their own racism is reflected in the advertising they create. And there's all kinds of things that these stereotypical images become the basis of, that become codified as policy in terms of how people feel about welfare, how people feel about a whole range of things. And so it's problematic, but people become immune to the ads, even though if somebody were to talk about their mother the way that these ads talk about their parents, they would be outraged.
Well, one of the amazing things to me in watching the awards last night was you really got the sense of the all-pervading nature of advertising. I think somebody said that the average person by the time they're 20 has seen 600,000 ads, and it's the overwhelming nature of advertising in everyday life, I think, was brought out very heavily. What do you see the possibilities for consumers or the general public to have any kind of impact on the all-pervasive nature of advertising?
Well, I think there's sort of two ways to look at it. There's sort of neck muscle strategies. That is, how can consumers fight this onslaught of just sort of terror and commercialism and abuse? And then there's sort of boot strategies, and that is, what can these industries do about how they attack us? We have a tendency to focus on the neck muscle strategy. So we teach kids to be good consumers. We teach them to be media literate and all these other kinds of cool things, which are important. But there's also some ways in which these guys, these corporations, have to come under control. Last night, there were video news releases where you had companies putting out videos masquerading as news. That's problematic. They should not appear without some kind of demarcation, some kind of thing that lets you know this is a commercial, not a news show. This should be public space. It should actually be absolutely banned from having commercial space. So there's a number of things that part of it is about what we can do as consumers, but most of it is about what these corporations should be forced to do to regulate this behavior.
We're also joined by Shelley Pasnick, Director of Children's Policy at the Center for Media Education. You got up and you were using your mouse to show us what was on the Internet right now around advertising. What's happening?
Well, we have been doing extensive research to learn more about the way companies are going after children on the World Wide Web. This is a medium that is being hyped as the panacea for educational ills. And there is tremendous potential. However, companies are going after children in a very aggressive manner, and they're creating online presences that appeal to youth. Specifically, they're creating games or different activities that solicit personally identifiable information from children, and this raises intense privacy concerns. Children do not have the cognitive abilities to understand always when they're seeing an advertisement and when they're seeing the content, and companies are preying upon this vulnerability and further blurring that line.
You used the example of McDonald's last night.
Yeah, absolutely. McDonald's is using a trend or something that we find to be very typical, that is the creation of a product spokes character. And so you've got Ronald McDonald saying, "Hi, write to me." And through this mechanism, McDonald's is able to collect information about individual children. You have to keep in mind that the goal here is not to create advertisements that are going to appeal to mass audiences. Instead, there's a trend toward one-to-one marketing. How do I know individual consumers, their likes, their desires, their needs, and what's going to make them act a certain way, and eventually what's going to make them buy a certain product? The goal is to create brand loyalty as early as possible.
And beside McDonald's, what are the other companies that stand out most on the cutting edge of this new propaganda effort?
Basically, any company that you can that comes to mind when you think of children's culture, they've got an online presence. However, alcohol and tobacco companies are also seeing this as fertile opportunity or fertile frontier to create messages. They have been kept off the airwaves and off of radio and television, but now they're seeing the World Wide Web as a golden opportunity to pitch their products to young people. So Budweiser is a perfect example. They use popular icons talking about music and sports, and of course the ever-famous Budweiser frogs that are extremely appealing to young people. You know, recent studies have shown that children are more likely to recognize the Budweiser frogs than they are Bugs Bunny.
Oh my God. You hear a lot, especially from conservative politicians, about pornography on the internet and how we have to regulate that. What do you think should be done about advertising on the internet, especially directed at kids?
Well, we've been working very extensively with the Federal Trade Commission. They've taken up this whole notion of privacy and are trying to figure out what can be done within this commercial marketplace to protect children. And so we're actively encouraging the Federal Trade Commission to create guidelines or safeguards that would protect children. But then also we're trying to have a conversation with different companies to encourage responsible advertising, that there are some approaches that simply shouldn't be taken. For example, should children, let's say under the age of 12, receive unsolicited email messages? That's something that's happened. So you visit, let's say, the Kellogg site, and after giving them your email address, lo and behold, in your email box, you're going to find a message that is signed Snap, Crackle, and Pop. But then also encouraging parental involvement. We'd like to see parents become involved when they see outrageous advertising, not to accept it, but to write to companies and say that, you know, simply this shouldn't be taking place.
And of course, what's different here is that they're soliciting information from the kids. This is not just a kid seeing advertising. Makani, you want to say something?
Yeah, I just want to say, before I was at the Praxis Project, I used to be the head of the Center for Media and Policy Analysis at the Marin Institute that did the first study on alcohol on the internet in 1995. And one of the things that was that we found it and during that point was one that there some companies just shouldn't be on the internet advertising. And I think that's one of the important things. I mean, there should be some places that they just should not be, or that there should be ways in which, just like in real life, kids should be restricted from those areas, then they should be restricted from those areas on the internet. Right now, we don't have the technology really to do that. Parents can either program certain sites for their kids not to go to once they know what they are. But the technology really doesn't allow for parents to really get in and be parents the way that a lot of the right is asking us to be. I mean, as a mother myself, they say, well, you need to be in control of this. Well, how can I be in control of this huge infrastructure? Know it, map it, and then tell my children where or not to go. And it's not like I'm physically restricting them. They're sitting in my own house with their mouse moving around. And I think that people have no idea what this means.
Maybe you just have to buy a mousetrap.
I mean, that's it, you know? I mean, people have no idea what this means, and I think that, and it's not just about the internet in terms of sort of one class of people who are sort of cruising it, but the equivalent is the real highway. I mean, that you get in the car, and you go into communities that are mixed zone, that have businesses and houses, which tend to be working class or poorer communities, that are bombarded by billboards, bombarded by images that are supposed to be appealing to kids. I mean, right now there's a Joe Camel menthol campaign that essentially markets to young African-American and Latino kids billboards on top of billboards that use basically gangster rap, hip poses, cool poses, and enlarge the cigarettes to look like blunts, like cigars, like these Camels are now smoking marijuana, and to link those things. I mean, so there's a whole range of images that are bombarding people that they cannot shut off. And the only entity that can really shut off or control this is the government.
Well, one of the amazing things to me about the awards was the number of people who are actually in the media, whether they were in advertising, online people, or journalists, who were there and were in essence revealing the secrets of each particular discipline. And for instance, I as a journalist was shocked that TV does have these packaged news events that mm-hmm. that companies create and then give to various stations. It's the best one, the one that they showed last night, was the special you see every year about this time about going to the beach and putting on your sunscreen, and that this is actually packaged by the industry.
Some people are talking about some lawsuits because we're not being told that these are actually video advertisements that are being used in newscasts. We want to thank you both very much for joining us and find out, see if we can get a number from you about your from your group. Makani Themba, co-director of Praxis Project, how can people get in touch with you in Oakland, California?
Well, we're in Oakland at 510-655-3112.
That's 510-655-3112. And Shelley Pasnick at the Center for Media Education, our website?
Our website is www.cme.org/CME. And, of course, you can telephone at 202-628-2620.
That's 202-628-2620. I want to thank you both very much for being with us before you leave New York City. And Juan, thanks for being with us this morning. Juan Gonzalez, columnist with the New York Daily News. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back to talk about Haiti after the Caribbean Summit. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton this past weekend finished up his two-day summit of Caribbean leaders, except for Cuban President Fidel Castro. They met in Barbados. Today we're going to take a look at Haiti and a very serious situation that has arisen there. It looks like there is famine in a part of Haiti. We're joined right now by two people who are here through the Caribbean Summit, but they were in New York City. Tim Wise is Executive Director of Grassroots International, a group based in Massachusetts that provides direct material to support to grassroots groups in the developing world, and they have a particular project in Haiti. We're also joined by Kami Chalmers of the Haitian Platform for Alternative Development. And we're going to begin with Kami, who is translated by Tim. We'll also talk to Tim separately. Kami, can you tell us about the situation in Haiti right now?
Sí, es una situación bastante crítica en algunas regiones del país, especialmente en el Plato Central.
The situation right now is particularly grave, particularly in the central region, the Artibonite, and in the northwest. In the northwest, there are reports of famine with 350,000 people threatened right now. There are children who have died of hunger. They're talking about dozens of children who have died. And people who aren't finding anything to eat are creating things to eat out of anything they can find, mixing dirt with seeds and anything else that they can put their hands on. It's significant that this crisis is coming in an area that has been the recipient of massive amounts of food aid since 1954, and where the food aid has come in and destroyed local production by making it harder for producers to produce and undercutting the local production of basic foods.
How exactly does it do that?
Sí, la situación es la siguiente, es que hay dos elementos que fueron complementarios en la
There were two, it happens in two different ways. There are two ways that that this has caused a destruction of Haitian food production in the region. The first is by changing consumption patterns in Haiti. USAID, for example, boasts that it distributes 1.2 million plates of food through its school feeding programs every day. All of those dishes are based on U.S.-grown wheat. Haiti does not produce any wheat. A child who has eaten wheat five times every week for years is surely going to demand and want wheat, and that will increase the demand for foreign-grown products and Haiti's dependency on food imports. The second is the change in tariffs policy. Haiti, being the poorest country in the hemisphere, also has the lowest tariffs in the entire hemisphere. Tariffs not going above 10%. What you see now is that 50% of the food consumed in the country comes from outside. In 1985, for example, Haiti bought 7,000 metric tons of rice. Only 10 years later, in 1995, Haiti was buying 197,000 metric tons of rice.
And
during the same period, the Haitian production of rice was dropping. This is a direct consequence of the economic policies being followed in Haiti, policies that that follow the hypothesis that the Haitian peasantry really has no future. What USAID and the World Bank want is to expel Haitian peasants from the land, have them move to the cities and seek jobs in sweatshops, working for low wages in Port-au-Prince. And this is seen very clearly in USAID's program. In USAID's budget for 95 and 96, only 4.6% of their entire budget went for agricultural production. In the years 94 and 95, all the international aid coming into Haiti that totaled $516 million, only 1.2% of that went for agriculture.
We're talking to Kami Chalmers, who is head of the Platform for Alternative Development in Haiti. He's just come up to the United States. And Tim Wise is executive director of Grassroots International. Tim, we're going to now talk to you not as translator, but as executive director of Grassroots International. In addition to the famine and drought, we hear that people are leaving, trying to leave Haiti. Once again, boat people.
Yeah, I think it's a measure of the economic desperation that's been created by these policies. In March, there were two different reports of overloaded boats capsizing as they fled the Northwest, very clearly fleeing the famine conditions. 31 in the two different capsizings, 31 people lost their lives. And it's striking because these are not people fleeing military repression anymore. They're fleeing failed economic policies.
What is Grassroots International doing?
Where Grassroots International is, the speaking tour with Camille Chalmer is part of a Haiti food security campaign that Grassroots International is involved in to raise public awareness about the desperate food situation in Haiti and the fact that U.S. policies, which involve a massive U.S. aid program in Haiti, are contributing to that problem. We have a responsibility in this country to change those policies. We also have the opportunity, through organizations like Grassroots, to provide direct support to the Haitian peasant organizations that do have an alternative vision of society, that do have an alternative vision of development, that are prepared to invest in self-sufficiency in Haiti and self-reliance and in the kinds of policies that the Haitian popular movement, the pro-democracy movement, has been demanding ever since it threw out Duvalier.
In a piece that came out in Newsday just a few days ago, there is a response from the AID, the Agency for International Development Haiti Task Force in Washington, D.C., and they say they've heard the criticisms of Grassroots International and said the experience all over Latin America and the Caribbean over 10 years is that free market programs have been successful. They disagree with your premise that free market policies, including lower tariffs, are bad for Haiti.
If we're being accused of not supporting free market policies, we plead guilty. So would the Haitian farmers who are finding it more difficult to grow food than they were before the coup. I think USAID has been very blunt in its and candid, in fact, in its in its policies. It has said very clearly that it does not believe Haitian agriculture is viable. Haitian fruit production is not viable. They should follow these free market principles, which call for them to go to what Haiti's comparative advantage lies. It lies, according to USAID, in a quote-unquote hard-working labor force, read sweatshop labor. It rests in proximity to the U.S. market. It rests in tourism, but it occasionally rests in export agriculture, but it does not rest in food production, because the largest food producer in the world, the United States, is right next door and can produce all the food Haiti needs. That's no solution for Haiti. That's certainly no solution for the 4 million people who still live in the countryside and make their living off the land and who want to grow more food. The simplest and most direct thing and most cost-effective thing that any of us can do to help Haiti develop, and develop not just economically but also develop a democracy, is to invest in what the majority of the Haitian peasants are doing and want to do more of. That's grow food.
El Banco Mundial organizó recientemente en Haití, el primero 2 y 3 de abril, una reunión llamada Grupo Consultativo.
The World Bank just recently, in the beginning of April, organized a meeting in Haiti. This really highlighted for us the limited possibilities, the limited openings that exist for the Haitian people to participate in the decision-making process about these policies. They only invited Haitian non-governmental organizations like ourselves to participate in the sections of the agenda about fighting poverty. They invited only a limited number of NGOs, generally groups that are large, well-established, and generally funded by USAID, and who and left the discussion very limited, without any discussion of the global policies and the global dynamics that were creating poverty in the first place. For example, they did not allow the non-governmental sector to participate in the meetings between the bank and the private sector. The other insidious part of this program is that when they invite a couple of NGOs, like they did in this case, they say that they've invited civil society. These NGOs that get invited can't speak for the dozens of thousands of peasants who were trying to grow food in Haiti. The most important actors in Haitian society, the small producers, the 8,000 agricultural co-ops, the thousands and thousands of small and micro enterprises who constitute 60% of the employment in Port-au-Prince, all of those are marginalized from the discussion.
Where does your president, Haitian President René Préval, stand on the World Bank and AID policies? And has he spoken out on the drought and the famine?
Sí, hay que entender eso en un proceso largo, un proceso histórico largo.
We have to understand that question in its larger historical context. When President Aristide returned in 1994, he returned with an economic plan imposed on him by the international community that excluded a large number of the Haitian people. And when the Aristide government, when Prime Minister Claudette Wehrli in November of 1995 questioned not even the overall program, but the rhythm and timing of the privatization and government reform programs, aspects of the program, the response of the international community was brutal.
La USAID, la primera que reaccionó oficialmente, cortó toda la asistencia prometida.
The USAID, which was the first to react, completely cut its aid to Haiti. In response, cutting, for example, its PL-480 food aid distribution. The other organizations completely cut, for example, all of their payments for the balance of payment support in Haiti. As you well know, one of the results of these adjustment policies is that Haiti's government is tremendously dependent on the international community for financial support for the government itself.
85% del presupuesto de inversión del gobierno depende del extranjero.
85% of the budget for Haitian government budget for investment is comes from outside, and 45% of the operating budget comes from outside. So the decisions by USAID and other international actors created real chaos in the public finances in Haiti in that time. And upon taking power in early 1996, President Préval had practically imposed on him the conditions and the policies that this aid was conditioned on. And what we see now is that President Préval speaks very strongly about the need for agrarian reform, which is one of the most important priorities for Haitian development. The Haitian government doesn't have the resources to carry out a thorough agrarian reform. For example, the World Bank categorically rejected and emphatically rejected a call for an agricultural credit institution in Haiti, which would have been an absolutely critical for any agricultural development.
And President Préval is an agronomist himself.
Yes.
So, Camille Chalmers, what can people in this country do?
Primero, tomar conciencia que es muy grave que Haití.
First, take note that that Haiti is really dropped from people's interest since the re-election of President Clinton. And the process take note that the process we're going through now is absolutely critical for the long-term future of Haitian democracy. And take note that the economic policies being promoted and insisted upon are causing grave problems in the country, are causing chaos within the country and undermining true development. And take note that Haiti has survived 35 years of dictatorship, 3 years under a military regime, and that we do need help. We need aid, but we need aid that is directed at meeting the needs of the Haitian people, that is directed at helping those who have historically moved forward the cause of development in Haiti. Between 1968 and 1995, more than $2 billion was spent distributing food aid in Haiti. In the Northwest, where they're now reporting famine, it would have cost only $40 million to put in place a complete system of water catchment and irrigation that would have completely transformed the agricultural base of that area and allowed them to resist famine conditions. What we're asking for is that there be a complete shift in U.S. government policy and aid policy, and that aid be directed at policies that are intelligent, well thought out, and supportive of Haitian development.
I know you have to go. I just want to ask you one last unrelated question, though it's related to Haiti, and that is, Emmanuel Constant is in Queens selling MCI phone cards. He says he'll someday be president of Haiti. What do you think should happen to him?
Me parece que es una declaración totalmente insensata.
It seems to be a completely senseless proposal. Emmanuel Constant has absolutely no support in Haiti. He is considered a criminal. He has was responsible during the de facto regime for torturing civilians, for raping women, for a lot of the paramilitary abuses that occurred during that time. He is a criminal. His organization, FRAP, has no political base within Haitian society at this point.
What do you think U.S. should do to him? Do you think he should be deported to Haiti?
Yeah. Yo creo que es muy importante que todo se tome conciencia en Estados Unidos del peso que el gobierno de Estados Unidos podría tener.
I think it's very important to point out that the United States has a very heavy responsibility and role to play in promoting justice in Haiti. The United States government has in its possession 160,000 pages of archives that it is refusing to turn over to the Haitian government. That includes the names, the addresses, the locations of arms, the networks of the paramilitary groups that have terrorized Haiti. These should be returned to Haiti. The State Department should return them to Haiti, return this information to Haiti so that the Haitian government can use that information to break up these groups which continue to plague the country with sporadic violence. The return of Constant, the return of the documents are absolutely essential for creating confidence among the Haitian people that the United States government is capable of supporting justice and democracy in Haiti, and that the Haitian government can create a state that is responsive to the needs of its people.
Kami Shammer is the head of the Haitian Platform for Alternative Development based in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and Tim Wise, the executive director of Grassroots International based in Massachusetts. I spoke to them just a few days ago, right before President Clinton met with Haitian President René Préval in Barbados at the Caribbean Summit. Well, if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our engineer and assistant producer, Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Special thanks to Bernard White. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!